So let us continue where we left off this morning. So we have just started the very beginning of the gradual training with the simile of the elephant's footprint. And of course, one of the things that is interesting here is that the very fact that the gradual training actually begins with the appearance of the Buddha, appearance of a Tathagata in the world. Without that Tathagata, without that Buddha appearing, existing in the world, there is no gradual training here. The training only really starts when somebody makes that breakthrough and sees things for what they actually are here. So I think that is obviously an important point, to realize that somebody actually has to make that breakthrough first of all. Then these teachings come into existence. Then there is a gradual training. Before that, there is like fumbling around in the darkness. That's what there is before that. After that, there is some degree of path that you can follow. So we've just been looking at these qualities of the Buddha. We're coming towards the very end of the list of the qualities. The second last one here is awakened or enlightened, which is Buddha. And we have already seen some Buddha before. And these are just synonymous, just slightly different ways of saying the same thing. And the last one is blessed. Blessed is Bhagava. Bhagava is this word in India which means like the Lord or God or something like that. All the gods in India, they are called Bhagava. And all the greatest of the spiritual leaders are called Bhagava. And all the really bad scallywags are also called Bhagava because they want to lift themselves up, right, and be special. So this is the Bhagava. And I think Lord is actually quite a nice translation for that. This is a translation that is used by Maurice Walsh in the Long Discourses of the Buddha. And because that is roughly what it refers to, the idea of Bhagava. So these are the qualities of the Buddha. And one of the important things about the qualities of the Buddha or about the Buddha as a person is to make sure that we understand that the Buddha is human, right? He is not some kind of god, not some kind of unique person who is very different from everyone else. He is human just like the rest of us. And that is so important to be clear about that, because if we lose sight of that, if we have two pedestals, one is the God pedestal and one is the kind of enlightened human pedestal. If you put him on the wrong pedestal, then we will. It's very often more difficult to relate to the teachings and to relate to the Buddha as our teacher. Many of the suttas, you will see this later on, are suttas where the Buddha talks about his own life, what he did, like his autobiography, how he achieved awakening, what he did. Talking about some of the problems that he encountered on the path. And of course, all of those things, the practice that the Buddha did before his awakening, his own problems, all of that really only becomes meaningful if we understand that the Buddha is fully human just like us. Because what he's telling us is, this is what I did. These are the problems I had. I had these. I had to overcome these kind of defilements, this kind of wrong view. This is what I did. In other words, this is what you too should be doing here. And that only makes sense if the Buddha is one of us, if you like. If he also is human. If the Buddha is elevated in the wrong way, then it makes no sense anymore. You know, if the Buddha is some kind of cosmic principle or something like that, well, cosmic principles, they have a different kind of practice from ordinary human beings. And that is the problem there. So it is not as if we should not respect the Buddha, it's about respecting him in the right way, understanding what he actually is. And it's fascinating. You read some of the suttas where the Buddha talks about his story before his awakening, and he talks about his life, right? He says he had problems with ill will, right? That was also part of the problem of him. He had the sensual desire, it was part of his experience as well. Wrong view, he talks about in other places being a problem. Yes. So all of these things, all of the things that kind of everybody has problems with, the Buddha too had problem with that. And it's kind of, when you see that, you realize the humanity of the Buddha. You realize that we're all part of the same kind of category of beings. We're not different. The Buddha was there too. And what makes the Buddha different is the awakening experience. That is what makes him different. Not the basic quality of the Buddha as a human, but the fact that he had this insight. And what that means is that we all can have that insight. We all come from the same basic problems in life, and we all can have the same insights. Sometimes people think, oh, everyone can have it, but I don't think I can have those insights. I'm not really there yet. It's impossible for me. But that is actually just wrong view. And that is just the wrong idea of what it takes to have this insight. It doesn't take anything apart from being human. If you are reborn as a human, if you are here, you have a mind, you have a body, you can have these insights. That's all it takes, right? If you haven't got a mind or you haven't got a body, then maybe you can't have the insight. So as I usually like to say, if there are any zombies here, then please, now is the time to leave. But if you're not a zombie, you are in business, right? You are there, you have a mind, you have a chance to do this. So this is really all it takes. The five khandhas, that is where insight happens. It's just a matter of allowing this path to progress, to mature. Go back to the rain. Go allow the rain to kind of keep on falling. And then eventually these things will happen. So that is just a little bit about the Buddha for you. And it is so powerful. It is so astonishing to think that the greatest spiritual genius in human history is your teacher. This is the Buddhist point of view of this. And of course, I think it's true. But that is the Buddhist point of view. And that's kind of, whoa, it's something really powerful about that. Something astonishing. The fact that we are so, you can call it luck. Maybe it isn't luck. Maybe it's just, the conditions have come together in a certain way. But what an opportunity that is. What a wonderful thing that is. And what a kind of, once you have those teachings, okay, let's apply them. Let's use them. We have something very, very precious here. We have something that's far superior to any gold in the world. In another place, the Dhamma is compared to gold. But of course, gold is nothing compared to these teachings. How much happiness do you get out of gold? Not much, right? Okay, you have some golden jewelry or some whatever. Not such a big deal. This is the real gold. This is the real stuff. The thing that has a life-transforming opportunity right in front of your eyes when you read these suttas. And what a wonder! What an astonishing thing that is, that actually is the case. But now, let us move on. So, the idea then of the Tathagata, the Buddha arising in the world, is the idea of right view coming into existence. We're talking about the Buddha being the eye of the world, the Loka Chakku, the eye of the world. The Buddha has seen, one person has penetrated to the truth of these things. And of course, then once one person has penetrated that, then these things can also be passed on to other people. So once this has happened, the next thing, as we might expect, is the teaching of these teachings. That is what comes next. First the Buddha, then the Dhamma. And as a result of the Dhamma, then you have the Sangha arising afterwards. So this is what it says here. He declares, or more likely that he makes known, probably be a better way of putting this, he makes known, the Pali word is pavedeti, which quite literally makes known is quite a good translation for that. This world with its gods, its maras and its brahmas, this generation with its recluses, its brahmins, and its princes and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. Yeah, so this is the very first part here. The idea that he declares these things. It may seem a little bit strange that what he's declaring here. You wonder what really this is all about. But of course, what it really is about is really about the possibilities, the Buddhist idea of the cosmos, if you like, the various kinds of rebirths, the kind of beings that exist. We are in India, we are in a country which is very religious. India has always been a very religious country, and that's one of the reasons I think you find some of the greatest saints there, etc. And because of that, it has all these gods and maras and brahmas, and people would have understood straight away what the Buddha meant by this when he talked about these things. So he declares this, right? This then would include the rebirth possibilities and also the karma, how you get to these various destinations, etc. So the Buddha has understood all of these things, how it all fits together here. This generation with its recluses and Brahmins, what does that mean? What does it mean that he declares this or he makes it known? Should be pretty obvious, the Brahmins and the recluses, they are kind of walking down the street every day. You shouldn't really have to point it out, but I think the point here is that the comprehension of Dhamma, the understanding of reality, also includes the understanding of where and how the doctrines and the various teachings of others, the Brahmins, which were their inherited teaching from the past, going a long way back, and all the other sects that existed in India at the time, the understanding of what those teachings are, whether they are true, whether they fit in with the reality, where they go wrong, and all of these kind of things. So he has, suddenly when you have seen the truth, you also have the ability to judge the doctrines of others, whether they are correct, to what extent they are correct, and what not. And India in those days was this hodgepodge of doctrines, hodgepodge of theories. Everybody was kind of wandering around, declaring their own, sometimes interesting philosophies, sometimes absolutely mad philosophies that people had at that time. All kind of things that existed. And the Buddha would be able to then to see what worked and what didn't work. In those days, there were materialists, people who declare, just like today, when you die, that's it, everything comes to an end. Right? Sometimes we think that this is a kind of a modern idea, that we have all been religious before. But no, go back to the time of the Buddha. People were already had that point of view back then. There's nothing new under the sun, right? Things are just revolving, coming back again and again, the same kind of teachings. So when people say that the Buddha taught rebirth because that was kind of his cultural inheritance from the Indian culture of the time, that is not quite right. Indian culture was very broad. It included so many of these types of teachings already. And the Buddha had heard them. He knew about these things. So all of these teachings, there was another famous teacher at that time who had this teaching that whether you go on the southern bank of the river Ganges and you make all beings into one mass of flesh, cutting them down, mowing them down, killing everything, make it into one mass of flesh, whether you do that, there is no bad karma as a result. Or you walk on the northern bank of the river Ganges and you are generous and kind and caring and look after people, no good merit is made from that. People just walk on according to certain causes and conditions, and eventually they end up at Nirvana, regardless of what you do. This is the kind of ideas, right? And it goes really against all common sense, and you can see why these things are very dangerous. So this is what the Buddha declares then. He's able to see these things. That it's an obvious result of seeing how things actually are. Obviously, then you can start to compare with what people actually say. It's princes and its people. He declares this. Presumably, this is about karma. Why is it that some people are really wealthy and happy and healthy and intelligent, while other people are sad, miserable, poor, dirty, and etc., etc.? How come the world seems so unfair? And of course, that in Buddhism is explained through the laws of karma, that lack of fairness. Actually, it is fair in the big picture of things. Which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. This, of course, being one of those very important things in Buddhism, that whatever is taught is something that has been realized and understood. It is not just a matter of faith. It is not just a matter of something that has been passed down through previous generations. Well, now it is that a little bit, but of course these things can be realized also in the present day. But the idea that this has been known directly by the Buddha, of course, is one of those hallmarks of the Buddhist teachings, which makes it quite different from many other philosophies and religious teachings, perhaps. That is really mostly about rebirth and karma. He teaches that, rather, Dhamma becomes available in the world. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Has good results straight away. You start doing the doing the right thing. You feel good about it. In the middle, you do your meditation practice, and you get some astonishing results there. Good in the middle. And in the end, you have the profound insights on this path, even better. So it's good all the way through and getting better as you go along. With the right meaning and phrasing, sa attang, sa vyanjanang. Atta means like the goal, the purpose, the aim of the path. It has the right purpose, the right goal. It has a proper purpose, a proper goal. It is a real goal at the end, the ending of all suffering, the attainment of the highest happiness. That is like a real goal. And that goal is there available to you. And it has the right phrasing here, meaning that the way the Buddha talks about this, he talks about it in a way that is thought out properly. Every word has a certain meaning. Every word fits into this Dhamma teachings. And that is why it is often so interesting to analyze these teachings carefully, to look at every word, to make sure you contemplate every little thing that he says, because everything, in a sense, is interesting. Nothing really superfluous there, nothing really lacking, as we shall see in a second. Everything is there. Of course, there is a slight problem with that, and that is that it's 2,500 years since the Buddha existed. And of course, we have the right to ask ourselves, is it preserved absolutely accurate through 2,500 years? And we know that that is basically impossible. Nothing is ever preserved that accurately. But what is interesting is that many of these core teachings that you find, the very things that we talked about at the beginning, the 37 aids to awakening and that kind of stuff, the core aspects of the Buddhist path, that seems to have been preserved in some cases almost verbatim over 2,500 years. And we know that through comparative research with different recensions in different languages, like the Chinese, Tibetan, Sanskrit, that kind of thing. And through comparative research, you can actually know that these things are almost exactly the same after vast time, spending vast amounts of time being passed down in separate lineages. Still, they are the same after 2,300 years or whatnot. So still, the phrasing is at least a lot of the time still kept pretty much intact. So it still is very meaningful often to look at individual words and phrases and to see what they mean. And that's what I'm kind of doing now, right? Pulling it apart, see how it all fits together. These teachings are so rich, so incredibly rich. Every word is so meaningful. That is why it is so fascinating to contemplate these things. And then, having given us this wonderful path, he reveals the holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Perfect is not the ideal translation. It should really be utterly complete and pure is the appropriate translation there. Paripunna means complete in all details. So the Brahmacharya is the holy life. Literally, Brahmacharya literally means the Brahma conduct, the Brahma behavior, that is what it means. Brahma, of course, being the a god that has been reborn in the realm that is roughly equivalent to the four jhanas, equivalent to the four Brahma viharas, the divine abidings, the metta, karuna, mudita, and upeka. So these are the very high beings that are very, very pure. So it is the pure conduct, right? At the very top, kind of the almost of samsaric existence. That is the Brahma conduct. So the word Brahma in the Buddhist teachings has this double meaning. The meaning of, on the one hand, these beings, and of course referring back to the Brahma of the Hindu tradition, which is the supreme god or the supreme principle of the Hindu tradition, or the Brahmanical tradition. And at the same time, it also means just the highest, the best, like the best kind of conduct, the best kind of quality here. So you reveal that Brahmacharya, utterly complete, all the factors are there. So when you read the suttas, you get everything you need. You don't really need anything more. It is all there. You don't need the Abhidhamma. You don't need the Mahayana suttas. You don't need necessarily the commentary. Some of these things might be a little bit useful sometimes, but you don't actually really need them. The suttas are self-sufficient. It's one of those weird things in life, isn't it, that in the very early days all they had were the suttas. Sometimes they had very little, because you would go to the Buddha would give you a teaching, and then you would take that teaching with you, and you would practice accordingly, and then you would become an arahant. That was in the early days. You had one teaching. These days we read the four Nikayas, and when we finish, when we finish the four Nikayas, are you an arahant? No way. You are. What am I going to read next? Okay, Abhidhamma, Visuddhimagga, commentaries, Mahayana suttas. Yeah, but in those days, actually, all you really required, all you needed was something very small. And if you really put your mind to that little teaching and you practice it fully, then of course you can go a long, long way on the path. And somewhere in the suttas it says something to the effect that if you practice one four-lined verse, one verse or four lines, and you practice that fully and you really give it everything, then that is what it means to be learned in the Dhamma. If you practice the one line verse fully and you become an arahant, then you are learned in the Dhamma. That's all you require sometimes. So it's interesting, the more suttas we have, the more access we have to books, the fewer arahants you have, right? The more it's one of those very kind of strange things in the world that we tend to get sidetracked perhaps by too much reading. But also, I think it is fair to say that because we are so far removed from the Buddha in many ways, it means we need a little bit more teaching to kind of get that confidence and faith in these things. And this is probably one of the reasons for this. So these teachings are complete, and they are complete, utterly pure. In other words, they have all the factors that are required for purity in their kevala paripunnang parisuddhang. Parisuddha is a purity in the Pali language. So this is the Dhamma coming into existence, right? The Buddha declares these things, and when the Buddha declares those things, somebody will be listening, and then that is how the Sangha and the lay, upasakas and the upasikas, how they come into existence, the lay followers and the monastic followers. And that is the next thing here that happens here. So then the Buddha says, a householder or a householder's son, maybe also a householder's daughter, right, would also be included there, or one born in some other clan, here is that Dhamma. On hearing the Dhamma, he or she acquires faith in the Tathagata. So, the suttas are always very male-centric, and it's important to understand that doesn't mean that they actually are, that the message is only for the male gender, it's for everyone. It is just the way that things were done in those days. I think things were very male-centric. So keep that in mind, because sometimes if you're a woman, you might feel a bit left out, which is really unfair, because there are lots and lots of women, usually more women actually, who are interested in Dhamma practice than men. So that is a bit unfortunate that it should have this kind of gender lean. But everybody is included there, not only monastics, but also lay people. One of the things that you see in the sutta is that often the same teaching is given to everyone. And so everyone is really included. The difference is really only on the commitment that you have to the path. That is the difference. That, of course, can be quite an important difference. But I would say the difference is often not so much necessarily between that monastics are always more committed than the lay people. Sometimes the difference is more greater between each group. Right, there are certain monastics who are really committed to the path, some who are not at all, and the same thing with the lay people, some who are incredibly committed, and some who are just kind of Buddhist in name. So this more vast span is more within each group rather than across the groups very often. So who are these people who go forth? Why does the Buddha say this? A householder and householder's son. Sounds a bit, why doesn't it just say a person goes forth? End of story. And kind of using a lot of words to say something. And I think the purpose here is that in those days, the householders, this was the establishment in India. These were the people who had the money. These were the people who had the education. These were the people who had kind of were on top of society in many ways. They were the ones who owned the house and owned perhaps the business and owned the fields, right, that were connected to that house. They would have servants. They would have the whole family would be living together often. They would have servants and slaves and workers and all of these things that would kind of live together with him in the house. So these were the establishment, the units, if you like, of the ancient Indian society here. So it was these householders that went forth, of course, is significant because it means that those people who already had everything in society, they were the ones who went forth. So and they went forth because they were educated, so they were able to kind of understand what was going on. But also the point here is that even if you are on top of society, of course the Dhamma is not just because you are poor and you don't know how to make a living and you got to kind of go begging because of that. That's not what the Dhamma is about. The Dhamma is about ending suffering. It doesn't matter what station you have in life. It doesn't matter whether you're rich and poor, educated or not, intelligent or stupid. It's for everyone. And especially for those people who have that ability to see what is going on. And these were the householders and their sons and presumably also their daughters, the people in society who were kind of on top of everything. And if you look at the suttas and you look at the background of many of the monastics in those days, you will see that precisely the Brahmin was at that time the highest caste, the highest caste at that time probably were the Kshatriyas, Kshatriyas being the aristocracy, the noble caste. They were probably just as high as the Brahmins, but it is overrepresented by the higher caste in India, the people who went forth in the Buddhist teachings. So it was a very kind of, people who were educated tended to be the ones who were attracted to Buddhism at that time. Maybe because the Dhamma was kind of hard to grasp, you had to have a kind of certain ability to think, outside the box perhaps, to be able to grasp what was going on, something like that. So that's, so that is what is going on there. And then it also says, or one born in some other clan. So that's kind of everybody else. That's everyone. And this is also the interesting thing about the Dhamma. It is not just for the high caste. It is for everyone. And anyone who has the ability to understand that this Dhamma is important, of course, is welcome in there. And there are some very interesting stories about people who were very poor and very poorly educated, who became into the Sangha and who attained full awakening as well. Even though they had a very difficult and challenging start to life, still they were able to attain the Dhamma. There is one story about a monk called Chulapantaka, which means Chulapanta is like a road. So Chulapantaka has been translated as the wayfarer, the kind of the younger wayfarer. Chula means like the lesser wayfarer or something like that. And he was supposed to be so dim, so stupid, so utterly, completely hopeless in Buddhism. He couldn't do anything. He couldn't remember a single verse. He couldn't do any chanting. He could barely get his robe on right, and all of these kind of things. And he goes to the Buddha and says, I can't learn any of this Dhamma. The Buddha says to him and gives him some very simple instruction. He gives him a piece of cloth, a white cloth, and says, take this white cloth with you and then contemplate that white cloth as you, as you kind of carry it around with you. So he contemplates this white cloth and he sees that over time as he kind of handles it, it becomes dirty. And through that simple act of seeing how the white cloth becomes dirty, he understands how the mind becomes defiled through defilements in actually exactly the same way. So he wasn't really stupid. He was just that he didn't have the intellect to think in a kind of rational way. But in terms of similes, in terms of metaphor, he was able to understand what was going on. And he became an arahant later on. And then he became very famous. There's another story of Chulapantaka when he was teaching the bhikkhunis. The bhikkhunis asked, who is going to teach us this week? Oh, it's Chulapantaka. They said, oh no, not Chulapantaka. Please. He's the worst. He doesn't know anything. He always recites this one verse again and again and again. This is going to be a waste of time to go and listen to Chulapantaka. So I hope, sometimes I go and teach the bhikkhunis at Dhammasara. I hope they don't think that when I come. Oh no, not that Brahmali fellow. Anyway, so they... I know two verses, maybe. So, Srila Pantaka, gets up and he starts saying this verse and verse again and again and again. And then one of the beaconers whispers to another beaconer, "Didn't I tell you this was going to be a waste of time?" And then Srila Pantaka hears that, right? And this kind of fires him up because he's an arahant. He doesn't know any Dhamma, but he is an arahant. So he gets up into the air, you know, walks back and forth in space, throws out kind of flames and water out of his body, sits down, lies down in space, and all of these kind of things. And then the beaconer is like, "Whoa, look at this." And then he keeps on saying the same verse, right? But suddenly the verse has much more impact than it used to have. Because now he's kind of using all these powers at the same time. So then he becomes a favorite of the beginners, I think. It's a nice little story, and it shows you how context is so important sometimes. So anyway, that's the idea of Srila Pantaka. He may have been one of those who came from the other clan, some other clan, right? It doesn't say quite which one. So this is one of the important things, that the Dhamma is for everyone who is able to understand and willing to kind of try it out and check it out. This is one of the nice things about Bodhinyana Monastery. If somebody comes to ordain, we don't really ask many questions. We say, okay, give it a shot and see what happens. And if you can't make it, that's fine. If you can't make it, that's wonderful. And it's just up to you to try it out. That's kind of Ajahn Brahm's philosophy here. And sometimes the monks say, "No, please, not him. We don't want him to." That's very rare that we do that. Okay, so it goes on. On hearing the Dhamma, he acquires faith in the Tathagata. Yeah? So you hear the Dhamma and you look at the Buddha at the same time. And you see that actions and speech, they match with each other. The Buddha doesn't just say, "Overcome defilements." He has overcome the defilements. And you hear some very powerful, beautiful teachings. You recognize the truth. The Buddha will tell you there is suffering in life. There is problems. You are attached. When those attachments get challenged, you will suffer. And we just all know how true that is. We know that whenever you attach to something, then you are opening yourself up for suffering as a consequence. So you hear this. You see the Buddha living up to his own teachings. And because he does that, you acquire faith in the Tathagata. And when you possess that faith, you consider how so life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. Household life is crowded and dusty here. So, especially in those days, because they would live in large families, I think it says somewhere that we live in a large bed crowded with children. That was kind of one of the phrases from the suttas. So it was actually quite crowded. And dusty here is a metaphor for the defilements. Dust, a path of dust, the path of defilements. And you know what it's like when you live very close to somebody, you tend to rub up against each other. And in family life, it's very easy to get irritated by little things that happen and all these kind of things in life, precisely because of the attachments, because of the closeness that we have to each other. We love each other a lot, but at the same time, we also irritate each other quite a bit. And this is kind of what life often is like when we live very closely together. And this is one of the things that I find so nice about monastic life, is that you always withdraw, you spend pretty much as much time by yourself as you like. There's something very freeing about that, very beautiful about that. Pulling back, it's like you almost always have some degree of perspective on the people around you. You never get so close that you lose that sense of perspective. And that enables you to live life in a more pure way as a consequence. There's less of this kind of rubbing up against each other all the time. And this is one, I think, personally, one of the great benefits of monastic life, having a kuti by yourself in the forest where all you can see is kangaroos and kookaburras and that kind of stuff. So you consider that, and then you know that life gone forth is wide open, right? What I was just saying now, the opposite, the idea of wide open is the opposite of crowded, of course, and dusty. And then it is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life utterly complete and pure as a polished shell. In other words, even the basic sila, the basic work on our character to make sure that we have a compassion and metta and balance of mind all the time, even that most basic foundation of the path is actually more difficult when you live in a home than it is when you live as a monastic, precisely for these reasons. And because of that, of course, this is one of the reasons why the Buddha lays down the monastic life. Because ideally, not always, because sometimes it depends who you live with and where you live and all of these kind of factors. But ideally, when the monastic life is well lived, it is the kind of the highway to awakening. That is the whole purpose of it. So sometimes people say, oh yeah, these days, monasticism is obsolete, no need for that anymore. But that is really, I think, a complete misunderstanding of the whole Buddhist path. Monasticism is never really obsolete, because monasticism is what, if you want to express the Dhamma through a way of life, monasticism comes closest to an expression of what the Dhamma is like. So if you live according to the kind of the goal of the path, where the path is going, then of course you're also living in a way that gives you more, a quicker access to that goal at the same time. It's almost as if you're trying to live it straight away, and that gives you that advantage in practicing it. Okay, so you decide then to go forth. He thinks, or she thinks, suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and go forth from home life into homelessness. Yeah, the idea of homelessness, this has many different kind of degrees. You find people who kind of wander around in the jungle all the time and only stay put perhaps for a few months of the year, but they are wanderers in a very real sense. Still these days, sometimes you find people like that. Maybe talk about that a little bit later on, but very, very difficult lifestyle. And then you find this kind of more homelessness, which is a little bit less homelessness. It's like we live at Bodhinyana Monastery or Dhammasara, where you have a kuti in the forest. It's not your kuti. It belongs to the Sangha, or legally it actually belongs to the Buddhist Society of WA, but it's really a part of the Sangha property. And then you move around from one kuti to another one. You don't really get settled any particular place. That is more kind of an intermediary stage. And then, of course, you have monastics who live even more like householders in different places. So different degrees of this and how this is lived out. And then because he thinks like this, then on a later occasion, he abandons a small or a large fortune, abandons a small or a large circle of relatives. He shaves off his hair and beard, puts on the ochre robe, and goes forth from the home life into homelessness. And this is when you get the Sangha, third part of the triple gem, the third part of the three refuges, rather. You get right there. So now you have the three things. What we are seeing here then, right? We're seeing the Buddha teaches him the Dhamma. And then when he accepts that teaching, it means that he also is getting right view. So now right view is being transferred from the Buddha to other people. Initially, it is only partial right view. Eventually, as he practices that path, he becomes a stream entry, he becomes a full right view. But at least the very first aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path has started at that point. So this is where the Noble Eightfold Path begins. Right view gets established in that person who goes forth. And when right view gets established, that's when they think, oh, maybe I should go forth. Right? And that thought of going forth then is Samma Sankappa. Sankappa means it's often translated as intention, but it means almost like a plan, right? It means a aim. It means where you are heading towards, a purpose in life. You get the right purpose. Once you have right view, you can see why right purpose and right aim must come from that. Suddenly you want to do those things that actually lead to something positive, something that leads to happiness, etc. The right aim comes about as a consequence of that. So this is what is happening here. And of course, then once you have the right aim, then of course the training really starts. And that is why from here on we see how the training begins, starting with morality in a very broad sense, and morality of the mind, and then meditation and all of that coming down the road. So the whole Eightfold Path unfolds on that basis. But let's look a little bit more at these things that we just mentioned now. So on a later occasion, you abandon a small and a large fortune. It is one of those strange things that if you look at the rules for a monastic, there is no rule there against owning things. You can own kutis, right? Even large kutis, kutis like a hut in the forest, a monastic hut. You can own these things. But there's very little, there are very few rules against ownership, but the rule is actually found here. It's in the gradual training. That is where the rule, if you like, is found. And this, of course, is far more important for a monastic. The Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, are always primary. This is where the real instructions are found. The Vinaya, the actual rules we follow, are secondary to that. They follow on as a consequence of the Dhamma. So this is interesting. You actually, when you enter the monastic life, you give up everything. And you kind of just get your ball and robe, and that's what you have. And we will see that later on, how that actually works on the monastic path. In reality, of course, in our monastery, we tend to take things a bit more slowly. So Ajahn Brahm always says, well, okay, you're going to ordain. Well, don't give up everything yet. Just try it out, because if it kind of doesn't work out, then you have something to fall back upon if you return to lay life again. So just one of those practicalities. But the ideal here is really to give everything up, at least mentally. And then when time is right, you give it up completely as well. And also giving up a large and a small circle of relatives. Yeah, this is one of those things that may sound a bit harsh. You go forth, you leave everyone behind, your parents, if you already have children, you leave your children behind, and that kind of stuff. It may sound a bit harsh, but again, the idea here is not, this is not an absolute abandoning whereby you never see them again. It is more like, okay, I'm giving you up in a sense of living together with you. But of course, sometimes you return and you share perhaps what you have learned on the Buddhist path yourself with your family. And you can become, if you do it right, a great blessing for the rest of your family. Yeah, this is one of those great things about becoming a monastic. Initially, your parents are aghast that you want to become a monastic. You must be kidding. You want to be a monastic. What, you know, where did we go wrong? This is terrible. That's what my father said to me. Where have we gone wrong in the upbringing? And I thought, where? And I didn't really take too much notice, because it's obvious that parents are going to be slightly upset. This is the last thing they think about when they kind of bring you up, right? You become a monk. It's absolutely the last thing they think about. At least in my family, that was absolutely completely out of the blue. So, but what happens, and this is the power of these teachings, the power of the Dhamma, is that you just have to be very patient and very careful. And as you practice these teachings in the right way, you start to treat your parents well, right? Instead of being the kind of the rebellious son who always wants to kind of go his own way and do his own thing, you become nice. And your parents go, whoa, what's happened there? What's going on there? This kind of stuff happens, and because you realize as a monastic that the relationship to your parents is actually so important. It's one of those things the Buddha always emphasizes, treating your parents in the right way. Even if they don't treat you right, at the very least you can treat them rightly. And because of that, gradually as you do this, something very fundamental changes. And I have seen that happen in my life with my family. My brother is pretty much a Buddhist. My two parents are now pretty much Buddhist, right? And they, you know, my father listens to, whenever I give a talk at Dhammaloka, he gets on the internet, listens to the talk. It's very sweet, isn't it? I almost can't comprehend it, because the shift is so enormous. And it shows you, what it shows, the power of these teachings. If these teachings are presented reasonably well, and if you present the word of the Buddha rather than perhaps presenting your own word and these things, they are so powerful. If you listen to them, you can't help but being attracted to these things, if you have an open mind in the first place. And in this way, you do become a blessing for your family. And that's why you never, you don't give them up completely here. But what you do is you withdraw enough to get some clarity and understanding for yourself. And then you can practice them in the right way and then bring everyone in as a consequence. The only way, only person I'm having a bit of problem with is my sister. She's a bit resistant to the Dhamma. That is life as well. There's never the case that everybody is going to be convinced. That is also part of the training at the same time. So that is the abandoning of the small and the large circle of relatives. It is a relative abandonment, not a complete abandonment. And you do it in the right way. Then you cut off your hair and beard. And this, of course, is also what the Buddha himself did. The Buddha was a monk. He sometimes exchanged robes with other monks. And he also, of course, had a shaven head. He looked like a monk. And that is why when there were large groups of monastics coming together, they weren't able to tell which one was the Buddha. Which one is the Buddha? There's 1,000 monks there. If the Buddha was different, they would have known straight away. They didn't know that the monk, who the Buddha was. So the Buddha looked just like pretty much like everybody else. So there wasn't really any way of distinguishing him in that sense. And then you go forth from the home life into homelessness. And then we come to what happens once you go forth from home life. So this is what happens next. And this is then the path all the way to awakening that comes as a consequence. But I will stop there because otherwise I'm afraid it will be too much again. I think that is probably plenty already. And then we will continue with this tomorrow morning. In the meantime, as always, keep on. Don't forget to enjoy yourself. Have a good time. And then we'll see you again at 7:30 this evening.